Sunday Night Saffron, a babble about religion, politics and all things ethnic, with John Saffron and Father Bob Maguire.
Good evening, dear listeners. Good evening, Father Bob Maguire. Tonight, we're looking at role models. First, we're going to have Doc Brown. You know, he started off as a rapper, then he accidentally came a comedian. And now he likes to make sure he's a good role model, being a father of two children.
Mm-hmm. The front page of the Sun today, right? Front page, 2013, it's just a naked woman, and it just says, "Hello, boys," across her tits. That's what it says, right? That is the front cover of the number one selling newspaper in the UK. Not 30 years ago, today, when, you know, we're supposed to consider women as equals.
He's brought his new show of Mike and Men to Australia for the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. We'll be talking to him soon, Doc Brown. We're also going to meet Mark Isaacs, a cheeky young man who went off with the Salvation Army to Nauru.
Yes.
And he signed that form that said, "Oh, listen, I promise never to say anything. Never to say nothing."
All right.
Went over there and then he came back.
You wrote a book.
Yeah, and first thing he did, I'm going to pretend I never signed that confidentiality agreement.
Right.
And he's written a whole book, and he's going to talk to us about what happens over in Nauru.
Really and truly.
Out of our line of vision. His name's Mark Isaacs, if I didn't mention that. We're also going to be talking to Bryony Kimmings, who's another artiste. She's come out to Australia, and she dresses up her niece as a knight, I think.
Yeah, as a knight.
You know, to try to be a better role model. Show young girls they can have better role models.
Yeah.
You're listening to Sunday Night Saffron on Triple J.
Father Bob.
Yes, mate.
On the tram today, I was sitting there and everyone's like quiet and everyone's like alienated just with themselves, like looking at their own little smartphones. Then this crazy woman came on. And she started, like, she was there and she started going, "Ah, Princess Mary, ah, Queen Mary," or something like that. Like, no one knew what was going on. And she was, like, making everyone really uncomfortable. Mm. And then she just got off at the next stop. But then everyone started looking at it and they started going, "Wow, I wonder what that was about."
Mm.
And then everyone on the tram who had previously been isolated and alienated from each other and weren't noticing each other, everyone was talking on the tram about the woman who just come on and made a public spectacle.
Yeah, that's
the advantage of tricksters and troublemakers. Look at her.
Look, see. Brought them all together.
She brought us all together.
Probably a feature, I would say, of Melbourne trams.
Hmm.
You see? They've done away with the inspectors.
Yes, yeah, so now we've just got...
And they're now going to infest the trams with jokers.
Hmm.
See, wasn't a lovely idea. Thank you, mister.
Thank you very much. It was a missus.
How do you know it was a missus?
The crazy person was a missus, not a mister. I knew it because she was a woman who came on the tram.
No, but she might have been dressed up. Anyway, be that as it may. But that, did you talk? That's the main thing.
Did I talk?
Were you there on the tram?
No.
Did you take part in the conversation?
No, do you know what I did?
What did you do?
The yellow notepad out of my thing
notes.
And said, that'll be a nice opening remark for Sunday Night Saffron.
Oh, my God, opportunism.
Because you know why that is, Bob?
Why?
Because everything's shtick. When I'm walking the streets, I'm just hunting shtick. The other thing that happened earlier on today...
Did you take a photo?
No, I didn't take a photo. The other thing that came earlier on today, there was this man in my little inner city hub, and he just looked a bit more rugged, a bit more like a bushman than an inner city man. And he came up to me, started talking, and because he recognised me, and I was like, "Oh, yeah, so what's up?" or whatever. And he'd come out of the bush into regular, because he was called by the police, because the police had been informed that there was a giant goanna in a little grotty little room in my area.
Yeah, a giant goanna.
You know, one of those hotels where you can book them for the hour because you can get up to salacious stuff?
Yes.
So apparently, for some reason...
The goanna booked a room.
No, the goanna didn't book a room, but the man at reception at the seedy little place where you can book it for an hour to do what you may with Anyway, you know what I'm getting.
Go on, yeah.
Said, I'm nearly sure there's a giant goanna.
In the room.
Yes. So he called the police, and the police came down, and they weren't equipped because they're like inner city police. They don't know what the hell to do if there's like a goanna in the thing. They opened it up, and it's like there's this 4-foot goanna just in the bathtub. It's like, what do you do if you're the police and there's a 4-foot, like, I guess you could arrest it. But you don't, you know, inner city people don't know. They don't know
what
whether.
To do. I wouldn't know what
like,
to
do. Like, does that have a tarantula bite or something? You know what I mean? So then they rang up this guy, the bushman, and he came and he had to.
Oh, I see.
And he came
take
out.
The goanna.
Yeah, he came out of his cabin in the woods, you know, and drove down and then came up. Apparently his thing wasn't big enough.
His cage.
Yeah, because he's going, this is a bit odd. Why have I been called by the police to capture this goanna? And then we went in there. Did I say it was 4 foot? It was 5 foot.
Oh.
It was a 5-foot goanna in the bathtub.
No, and that, it's only got 4 feet.
Yes, but it was a 5 foot.
Oh, sorry.
The
5-footed goanna.
Yes. So they were my two adventures today.
Oh, that's exciting, isn't
and
it?
And do you know what happened when the man told me that? Pulled out the yellow notepad.
And made notes,
yes.
Oh, that's excellent.
Thank you.
So they used to call us out to capture bees.
When you were a beekeeper?
Yes, when you were a beekeeper. If somebody, there was a swarm, and somebody wouldn't know what to do with them, you see.
Mm.
Well, then you would be called out to blow a smoke on them. Not cigarettes smoke, for God's sake, out of a thing. And then when they were comatose, you would shake the thing, the whatever they were on, or knock them, and they'd all fall into a basket, and then you would take them away and allow them free into the wilderness.
Oh, that's nice.
But I had no notebook or selfie, you see, to take. Oh, that's good. Well, thanks for that. Now, you're saying that I should be carrying a yellow notepad around.
No.
To take notes during the week. I think I'm going to do that because I'd like to trump some of your stuff. You know, like the day that I found a body dead in the bed after 3 years.
After three years of what? What?
No, I'm making it up.
Oh, yeah, okay.
But that would be a good one, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that would be a good one. But they have to be, like, relatively true.
Considering it was my bed.
Yes.
That would trump yours, I think.
Dear listeners, stick around.
We're going
to be talking to Doc Brown, former rapper, now a comedian.
You're listening to Sunday Night Safran with John Safran and Father Bob Maguire on Triple J.
Later on in tonight's show, we're meeting a woman who dresses up her 9-year-old niece as a knight. So, you know, young girls can have more positive role models. It's like a performance, Bob. It's not just like randomly she's dressing up her niece as a knight and then that's the end of the story. Now, what do you think about role models? What kind of role models should tweens have? Jump on Twitter, at John Safran or at Father Bob, and let us know. Also coming up tonight, we have an ex-Salvation Army employee, Mark Isaacs, who went off to Nauru, to Australia's offshore processing centre, and signed a confidentiality agreement that he would not say what happened there once he left the island. But, you know, he seems to have broken his promise and has immediately written a book about it and will be coming on our show to talk about what was happening in those offshore detention centres. And soon you'll meet comedian and former hip-hopper, Doc Brown, who has taken gender equality and put it into the hands and minds of kids. But first, this.
You're listening to Sunday Night Safran on Triple J.
This is Sunday Night Safran on Triple J with me, Bob Maguire, and John Safran. And joining us right now is comedian and former rapper Doc Brown, who's brought his show of Mick and Men to Australia.
No, Mike.
It says it's here, Mick.
Yeah, no, it's
Mike
a pun.
And Men.
Yeah,
like Australia, not mice and men.
No, that's the pun.
It's like I know it's the pun, it's a contraction, I mean,
a contraction of microphone.
Why don't they write the goddamn things in phonetics so that elderly people are able to handle them?
That's true, and I will have my people killed.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you, Doctor. To Australia for the Melbourne International Comedy Festival.
Hey, Doc, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Now, you started off as a rapper. What kind of rapper were you?
I don't know. I was kind of an honest one, which was probably the reason I didn't reach the the heady heights that I planned to. I was very much your rapper next door, you know. I was around a lot of street guys, but I would never considered myself, you know, a street kind of rapper, although I did rap about street issues.
Yeah.
I always had the a lightness to what I did. There was always some humor. It was so often quite self-deprecating. And there was other things in there, you know, I rapped about girls and stuff as well. But I think I was, you know, I just never had that controversy that I think sells a lot of rappers. And I think that was detrimental to me at that time.
Because when you try to look you up on the internet to find about your rap career, it always seems to start once it became an ironic
career
in stand-up comedy.
Yeah, because that stuff's viral. You know, you're always going to go to the videos that have got like 1 million, 2 million, 3 million views. And they're, you know, songs about tea, you know, just the stupidest things I've ever written, things that I wrote on a whim, but it reaches a lot of people, and I don't want to cast aspersions on the rest of the world, but you know, you look at my actual back catalogue of more complex stuff, it's I think it's really for the hipsters and the aficionados of rap.
And did you, when you were rapping, were you sort of processing in your head going, oh, there's lots of rap out there that's kind of awkward and problematic, and
you mean when I was doing serious stuff?
Yes.
Yeah, very much so. I think like a lot of my stuff was kind of postmodern in that respect, that I was reacting to rap that I hated as much as rap that I loved. You know, I was inspired equally by both, and
what was the rap that you hated?
I think I always struggled with the stuff that was just monotone, basically. There was just one message the whole way through. I have no issue with like the odd misogynistic song or materialistic song. This is the thing that people seem to have most issues about with rap, or stuff that glamorized violence. I don't really have an issue with that as long as you just had one on your album. What really bugged me was the guys who had like 24 songs. There's always way too many songs on the album. And, you know, you're saying the same thing a million times. I couldn't fathom that. It drove me up the wall. And I used to write songs based on the conversations I had with people I respected. As simple as that. You know, conversations I have with my friends in the pub or wherever, you know, interesting topics come up, or funny topics, or just things that fascinate you. So I'd go home and write songs about that.
Rap's confusing because a lot of it, you can process it as there's a little wink at the camera. So you kind of go, well, this is okay, like he's playing a character. He's not really saying it's okay to drive by and shoot people. But then it becomes subjective to the listener as to whether you're hearing that wink at the camera or not.
I think you see the same thing in cinema, although directors and writers in Hollywood get a lot less grief. Like, you know, no one gets angry about the fact that Arnie's got a gun, you know. Even though it's really no different to 50 Cent having a gun in a rap song. It's not really there. So rappers get a lot more grief. However, I think most intelligent people know when it's tongue-in-cheek and when the rapper actually really wants you to think, no, dude, I'm serious. I will kill you, you know? I think we always know. That's why it was always so strange that Eminem caught so much flack, because I was like, are you not hearing the tone of his voice? Are you listening to something different from me? And I think a lot of the time there were people, journalists included, who were reading lyrics off a page rather than actually listening. I was like, listen to the song. Are you telling me you don't think he sounds sarcastic?
Yeah.
You don't think he sounds like a Peanuts character when he's delivering these lyrics? You know, I think you can always tell. And there was a song recently that had a great remix, but the original version is called UOENO, which was like a almost like an acronym, like a real street rap kind of acronym, because it's basically, if you say it fast, it's like, you only know, which is like, you know, if you're American in the street, it's like, you don't even know what I'm about. So the whole song is quite a boasty, like, you don't know the levels I'm on.
Speaking of,
and it featured a rapper, it featured a rapper called Rick Ross, who's probably one of the biggest rappers out at the moment. And he had a line where he basically humorlessly said, you know, I slipped this this drug into a girl's drink tonight, and you know, we ended up together. She didn't know much about it. great, you know. Like, no humour. So basically, you just date raped a girl. And there was actually quite a big outcry about it. And he lost his sponsorship with Reebok. They took it away, cancelled his adverts, and closed his deal down. So he had a little bit of comeuppance, but that's very rare. I think just because he was slightly higher up in the public eye, he didn't get away with that one. But like I say, that comparison with Eminem, I think if you're vaguely intelligent, I think you can hear in the person's voice, there's humour here. Oh, there's no humour there. I think he actually genuinely wants me to believe that and be impressed by it. And that really gets me, that really angers me.
Speaking of Eminem, years ago, I interviewed your sister,
okay,
Zadie Smith, mm-hmm, who's the author of White Teeth and lots of really highly respected books. And one interesting thing that came out in the interview was she said, she said she wrote the whole book listening to Eminem's mm-hmm first album again and again and again on loop. Mm-hmm. And that kind of like somehow fed its way into this widely regarded highbrow book.
I think that might well have been White Teeth, because White Teeth was around 2000, 2001. Yeah. Eminem's
he never gets credit for that. It's always all the bad. What about his contribution to highbrow?
He actually
book,
did
White
get
Teeth
credit for it in print, because she interviewed him for Vibe magazine, I think, on the release of his second album, the Slim Shady LP. So he got credit straight from the horse's mouth. But you're right. In general, you know, you wouldn't get that kind of thing. Rap for a lot of people is still to this day is like a dirty word. It's not considered up there as a musical art form with, you know, whatever, jazz, folk, classical, even rock and roll, you know, which is sad because a lot of it is, and a lot of it even surpasses some of that stuff. The issue is that the nature of the technicality of rap, having a basic rhyme flow with a basic 4/4 beat, it can be aped way easier than you can ape a 90-piece orchestra, you know? Therefore, there is a massive amount of utter tosh, which involves a lot of people who are just trying to shout louder than the other dude and say something more outrageous than the other dude. And that's the stuff that not only can make the headlines, but also drags down a lot of the quality stuff and envelops it in a kind of quagmire of, oh, that rap stuff, you know? So it's really hard for us. And for people like me who are like discerning rap fans, it's like, wow, finding good rap just gets harder and harder, but it is out there.
Now, can you please stick around, because we're going to be talking about Of Mice and Men with you.
Mm.
Sunday Night Saffron on Triple J.
We have a guest in, Doc Brown. First, let's take a listen to one of his little bits.
I've had some dark times, right, where I used to think it was like me against the world, you know, and I, in those times, you got to remember, it's not you, it's them. Because when you're down and out, and you're really up against it, just remember the basics. It's a mantra, repeatedly say this. You're not a loser, it's just everybody's racist.
Hey, Doc Brown, thanks for sticking around. I wish we heard more of that.
Yeah, there's some gags after that.
we like to play the bit without the gags.
Yeah, that happened on ABC the other day. I was on the breakfast show, and they said, hey, before we get into this interview, let's see Doc Brown at work. And they played a clip from Equality Street, the video I made with Ricky Gervais, and they played the opening 35, 40 seconds, so a lengthy clip, which doesn't involve me at all. It's just Ricky gurning to the camera for 40 seconds. Hey, thanks.
So you stumbled into comedy.
Yeah, very much so.
And now you're a comedian. But you see, this episode is about role models, so mm-hmm. It's all about being positive or something.
Okay.
So how do you try to be positive or something?
With honesty. I never claim to be a role model or be someone that people should look up to, because I've made a plethora of mistakes in my life that I still make with some alarming regularity as a grown man. So I would never say, hey, do as I do, not as I say. You know, I use the honesty of my own shortcomings, I think, to try and inspire kids in an underhand fashion. I don't set out to preach to anybody. You know, my show, the new show at the moment, is laced with a consistent left-wing hippie diatribe that is never overtly referred to. But when you see the whole hour, you come out thinking, oh my God, I think he just spent an hour trumpeting feminism, disparaging homophobia, encouraging race relations in between the sheets, recreational drugs, and loving each other. I think. I'm not sure. You know, and you come and see it again, you're like, oh my God, definitely. It's so obvious.
It's really hard.
I prefer to sneak it in.
Yeah, no, because it's really hard, as you said, to know what you're allowed to take the high moral ground about, because, you know, people will know about you in the real world,
yeah,
and they could just get on Twitter.
Yeah, no question. You know, and recently I've been sort of hailed in the UK as a kind of something of a postmodern feminist, and, you know, I can't label myself that because I know how badly I've treated women in my personal life. And I think, well, I don't know how I feel about that. But then at the same time, if you're going to start talking about equal rights or equal pay for women, then I'm going to tub thump. Why wouldn't I? You know, like I don't get why you'd be in any other stance, you know? So it's tough for me. So therefore I just, like you say, I try not to go out there and say, hey, look, I'm the second coming.
Bob, are you allowed to be, you know, have good social justice, you know, be proclaiming that whilst being sort of like flawed in your personal life?
Yes.
Oh, you are?
Yes.
Do you know what I was thinking about? Recently, John Pilger, that he was on the ABC on an interview, and he was just like really aggressive to the, like, unnecessarily sort of just a bit nasty. Like, just something where you kind of go, well, if we just peel away everything, you're just being a bit nasty. Mm. And so how does that fit? Because I always found that a bit weird when someone's proclaiming something that's quite difficult, like, hey, we've all got to give land back to Indigenous people, or something like very complicated, but then on something that's really easy, such as don't be sort of like a jerk when talking to people.
To your immigrant maid.
Yes. Don't be, then suddenly, like, he's not being kind of gracious, or he's being a bit nasty to this woman on a one-on-one. But
that's the conundrum all the time, stalking all of us.
Yeah, I mean, if you've ever gone out drinking with policemen or with teachers or social workers, or psychotherapists,
priests,
and I've done all those things, priests as well. What you find is it's hard to be a role model as part of your job. You know, like, a lot of these guys spend their whole day like holding back their most sort of animal instincts because they're responsible for vulnerable people, which is admirable. And then you go out on the town with them and they're the craziest dude in the whole group.
Yes.
And, you know, maybe they just got to let their hair down. I think, like, hey, listen, better to be a jerk with minimal victimization of vulnerable people than be in a powerful position and be 9-to-5 abusing that because of your own sadistic desires, you know? So, I don't know, man. I wouldn't swing the sword so heavily on those people. And I being in the world of celebrity as I am now, I see that pressure all the time on everybody. Like, these guys that are like rock and roll stars are expected to like live like angels. I'm like, what? Do you listen to their songs? Like, what do you want from this guy? You know, sometimes I see Marilyn Manson being torn apart. And I'm like, what? Does he present Play School? Like, he's like a rock and roll star.
Now, where is your show playing? Is it of Mike and Men?
It's at the Victoria Hotel on Little Collins Street. It's in the banquet room, which is downstairs as you come in. And,
wow, that's the most detailed.
Yeah, well, it kind of has to be, because if you walk past this place, you wouldn't think there was comedy going on in there, which obviously for me is a concern.
Yeah.
Last time I was here, it was just like, bang, like you walked out and there was, oh, it's a venue. There's some stuff going on in here. So I'm sure they'll dress it up and there'll be a sign, or maybe like one of those guys with the with the golf sale type signs, comedy in here. it's that kind of a setup. So yeah, you know, it's a great little venue. I went down there for the first time this afternoon, and it's got a vibe down there. It feels like a place where stories should be shared, and my style is very much anecdotal. I'm a storytelling comedian, no question. So I think we're going to have a nice connection down there tonight.
Or you can just go online and type in Melbourne Comedy Festival or something and find out the details. Thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Doc Brown.
Sunday Night Safran. Triple J.
You're listening to Sunday Night Safran with me, Bob McGuire, and that bloke, John Safran.
Father Bob, yes. What do they do at Goldman Sachs?
They count money, don't they? Or they?
Yeah, and Price Waterhouse Cooper.
All of those.
So they're like big financial institutions.
Yes, merchant bankers.
Because my
risk assessors.
Because my friend who works in finance, she was telling me that at companies like that they have these big gay nights,
like game nights.
No,
gay.
Yeah, as in homosexual nights.
Go on. What are you inferring?
No. Where it's like, hey, we want to show our gay employees
that they're
welcome. So they'll have like a special like gay function, and then they invite in like senior partners from interstate to come and talk. And so it's all about, hey, you can feel comfortable. We're a company you can feel comfortable being gay. It's all whatever. But my friend reckons that it's not really about, oh, let's all be nice and cuddly and all that stuff like that.
What's the twist in this?
That they've done their actuary.
Yes.
They're sort of like start, and it's like they think that gay employees, because they're not going to have children and all this kind of stuff, well, actually, they'll be able to work them harder and for longer. And so that's why there's like an advantage to having gay employees.
That they will last longer.
Yes.
They will work harder because of that gayness.
Well, you know, like often, not all the time, because obviously there's like adoption and all that stuff, but like often, like they won't have to, you know, take time off to have children and all that kind of stuff.
I see what you mean. That's forensic.
And my friend just reckons
that's rugged.
They've done the actuaries, and that's sort of what their motivation would
good
be.
Heavens. But
trying to get more and more.
Yes. So maybe, I heard also so maybe if that you're looking you for mentioned a job, your Price Waterhouse.
I was going to just say to the listener, so maybe if you're looking for a job and you're not a homosexual, maybe look into
somewhere else.
No, becoming a homosexual.
Oh, I see what you mean. We could have classes. Couldn't you?
Yes.
And the other thing too that Price Waterhouse mentioned was, I think one of the upcoming trends will be parcel deliveries. Delivering parcels will be one of the areas that you should invest in.
Do you know, I just realised I just did something really stupid then.
What did you do?
Because as you know, Bob, because the door was open to the studio for some reason, and I just, that whole last talk break, I'm like looking over like, oh my God, how do I sneak over and close that door without the listeners knowing? And then like I'm talking, I'm telling the story, but I'm just concentrating on that door. And then I threw to you, and then I sneak ever so softly over there and close the door. And then sneak back. And then I'm thinking, what kind of show? This is not like this slick show where, you know, like what am I, who am I putting on airs and graces for?
I was going to say, actually, while you were talking,
like, didn't I just say, oh, by the way, listen, I'm just going to walk over there and close the door. And then come back. Like,
or
why?
I could have called out, will you shut up out there? Something like that, something gracious.
Yes.
Oh, now you've told them.
Just seems like such a random thing for me to, like, be trying to cover up.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks for that. So the gayness is going to be now a subject of further study.
The
lessons and classes, not to cure people of being gay.
What?
But in fact to help them to appear to be gay.
Okay.
That's lovely. Thank you.
You know what the number four film at the US box office was this week?
No.
It was a Christian film called God's Not Dead. And it's about...
I've seen that.
You've seen the whole film, God's
no,
Not
I've
Dead.
I've seen the clip.
Yeah.
Yeah, the boy stands up in a university class.
And it's about a...
an atheist professor.
And a Christian student at university. It's like first year uni. And the atheist student has... No, the Christian student has to really firm up on his beliefs and work out ways to argue. And presumably at the end of the film, the atheist teacher is defeated or
well,
won
presumably.
Over.
Presumably. Because he tells them at the start of their classes, to sit in this class with me, I'm an atheist, you must all agree and subscribe to the fact God is dead.
And the lead guy, people were telling me on social media, is the guy who played Hercules in some version of Hercules.
Uh-huh.
Like people into comic books are quite excited that they're comic book hero from Hercules is the lead.
On the big screen.
Yes. I think there's like there's different dynamics. Like once you go into a Christian film, you can be like B grade from Hollywood and then you're A grade in the Christian. Yeah.
Yes.
So rather than being that leftover from that Hercules film 10 years ago, who where is he now? Suddenly you're the most famous person in a Christian film.
Yep.
So any B grade celebrities out there?
Yes.
Thinking of where to go?
Yes.
Why not try Christian films?
So you're not keen on Noah?
I'm not. What do you mean I'm not? The film?
Yeah, the film.
I haven't seen the film. I will go. I will go see it. I think I'm not only going. I'm going to go see it in the big puffy chair in the posh
the gold pass,
and then get drunk whilst watching it.
Ah, see. Because there's so much, you know, awash.
Isn't there a drunk scene in Noah? Oh, is Noah the one where...
Well, Noah's the one where his kids got him drunk.
Yeah. Is Noah... The kids get Noah...
I don't think it's Noah.
It's not Noah.
Noah. No,
or is it Abraham? Or is it Isaac?
Abraham. Yeah, I think it's Abraham.
That's one creepy story.
Yeah,
so what is it? The kid...
No, I can't tell you the details of it.
But why not? Because it's too X-rated.
Because what do they want to do? They sneak somebody into his bed or what do they do with him?
Yeah, it's something like that.
Yeah.
What are you asking me? I'm not the one who's putting myself up as the priest.
Well, it's your book.
Yeah, but it's your book too.
No, it's your book first. You had the book first.
Yes.
We just kind of, get the get squeezed and get the essence out of it.
Yeah, sure.
But you've got the details, haven't you? Well, you've done that.
What a disappointing this is to listeners. Like, because listeners would listen to this and go, listen, these guys might be idiots, but he's a priest.
Yeah.
And John does all the stuff about religion, so at least we can rely on them to tell us about religion.
Well,
and
Google
here we are.
On that
machine. Here we are stumbling over the freaking story of Noah.
I reckon it's Abraham.
Abraham drunk?
Yeah.
Listen, let's go to a song. I'll give you the results of my Google
The
song.
All right.
You're listening to Sunday Night Saffron with John Saffron and Father Bob McGuire on Triple J.
This is Sunday Night Saffron on Triple J. Joining us right now is Mark Isaacs, ex-Salvation Army employee and the author of The Undesirables.
Hey, Mark, how are you?
Hey, John, how are you going?
Good.
Hey, Father Bob.
Thank you, Mark.
Have I oversimplified the story too much? Where I've said you're some guy who joined the Salvation Army, but not as an officer, as a sort of guy?
As a support worker.
Yes.
That was, the official job description. I think Wiley is a bit rough.
Defamatory.
The,
yeah. And then you went over to Nauru, where there's the offshore detention centre.
Yep.
And then you had your time there, and then you came, and even though you'd signed a confidentiality agreement, then you come back and write a book.
Yeah, I don't think it's as simple a process as just going there and then writing a book and leaving as simple as that. I think there was a lot of steps towards getting to the point of publishing a book, and it wasn't a very easy decision to just go and say, oh, yeah, I'll write a book and then see how that goes.
What did you discover there that was different to what you presumed before you went there?
Before I left, I mean, I didn't know what to expect, really. We weren't given any kind of brief as to what the place would be like. And I had been to Villawood Detention Centre in Sydney and seen the conditions there. And I guess the comparison between the two would be that Nauru was rudimentary while Villawood was in some way civilised. It's very difficult to imagine the reality of a detention of a regional processing centre in Nauru when all you've ever really known is safe Australia. And so to arrive there at this camp and to hear the stories of these men and the tragic stories of these men and their journeys, and then to spend most of your days with them, with the main focus of their minds being when they can leave and the only answer you can give them is we don't know. I think that was the particularly difficult part, and then from there stems every other issue that arises out of the camp.
And it's as you said, it's it's pretty rudimentary. So it's all like tents and people sleeping in the heat and things like that, as opposed to like, you know, more firm structures.
Yeah, when I first arrived, that was the case. There was it was very much a camp that was not prepared to meet the needs of these men. And I think the only way you could assume that would be done is on purpose, because they knew they were going to be taking these people there, and they were housed in dark green army tents that reached 50 degrees in the heat, and they were sleeping on stretcher beds on wooden pallet floorboards. Over the time, those physical conditions improved. But the main issue is the psychological conditions, because as much as the camp improved physically, the psychological conditions worsened for the men.
And did you change your mind over your journey in other ways? Like did you meet people where you thought, well, you know, this person has, you know, they're a decent person, but, you know, they weren't necessarily running away from threats of being killed by a foreign government?
I think one of the biggest issues, biggest things that I learned while going over to Nauru was that there are all sorts of characters who are asylum seekers. You know, they come from all parts of the world. There are Muslims, there are atheists, there are Christians, there are homosexuals, and all their stories varied. And you know, some of the guys were magnificent human beings and were lovely, and some of the guys were horrible people and were quite contentious and really pushed our buttons. But the majority of the people made me realise that there are many forms of prejudice and oppression, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a fleeing death or fear of death to be accepted as a refugee. A lot of these people have never even lived in a country where peace existed. So some of these men were born, the people from Afghanistan say, were born into bombs and guns and gunfire, and have never lived in a place of peace. And a lot of these men were persecuted purely because of their race or their religion.
Because when I was reading your book, which I haven't finished it, but so maybe there's a twist at the end, don't give it away, but there were situations where I was just thinking, oh, someone who's pro these offshore detention or pro, you know, not letting in asylum seekers, they could read your book as sort of validation for their views, because you meet people who have sad stories. But for instance, you meet people who came here because they were hoping for a better life, and now they're ashamed to go home because it'd be so shameful to return without being able to, you know, they've let down their families or whatever. And so someone would read that and kind of go, well, that's not a reason to be an asylum seeker. You cover those stories in this book too.
Yeah, my aim was never to try and change opinions or force my opinions on other people. It was purely to express the reality of these camps, so people can make an informed decision when they want to agree or disagree with this policy. Because at the moment, what frustrates me about what's going on is that no one understands and no one knows what actually happens in this camp. And yes, there are definitely people that may not fit the bill of a genuine refugee, but that's why we have a processing system to decide who are the refugees and who aren't. And the statistics say that 90% of people who arrive by boat are refugees, but that still leaves 10% of people who aren't. And one of the issues in the camp is that we're putting people where statistics say most of them are refugees, we're placing them in indefinite detention and not processing them. So of the men that I worked with who have now been waiting for their refugee status to be determined for 18 months, not one of them has been processed yet. And when they were taken, and a large majority of the men have been taken off Nauru now and placed in Australia in the community, and they were told that if they wanted to leave Nauru, they'd have to sign a form to say they would start their processing again. So if these people aren't refugees, that's great, that's fine. Process them, tell them they're not a genuine refugee and then we won't accept them, and then let them get on with their lives.
The there were other things that were sort of made me realise things are way more complicated than both sides of the argument want to admit or even think about. And one thing is when you started talking about private companies that work on the island, like Transfield, who have got into heat recently because they were sponsoring that arts festival, and some of the artists and some academics said, well, we don't want a arts festival that's sponsored by Transfield because they, you know, I was told they build the prisons in the offshore detention centre. But then in the context of this book, you start talking about, well, they organise stuff and they bring in food and then there's like a health service there that's also a private company that's providing all the health services. And it's kind of like, well, I guess someone's got to do it. And what are people saying should happen? Like, if not these private companies provide health services and these private companies provide food, like what do people want to happen then?
I think that the anger surrounding this issue is the manner in which these people are kept and the language surrounding the debate. I think
but in this particular instance, it's not that. It's about private companies are unethical if they do business on these offshore detention centres. And I wonder if the people who say Transfield shouldn't be there would be saying, well, the private company that provides medical services to these men shouldn't be there, and it's unethical that there's this private company there providing medical services because they're reaping benefits off this offshore detention centre. But then on the other hand, someone has to be there to provide medical services, and I guess someone has to be there to provide food for the people who are on the island.
Yeah, and again, I reiterate, I think that when I was there, the issue that we really struggled over was when you work there, you feel complicit in this wrongdoing, because essentially that's what I felt. I felt this was a wrongdoing on the way these people were treated. But at the same time, the way we justified it to ourselves was saying you have to work within a system to change a system. So I think that again, the anger with these private companies going into these situations and profiteering out of these situations, yes, someone has to do it, but the manner in which these centres are set up makes people angry about what's happening there. So if we address this topic as with the truths of the situation and said these people need our protection, but we have limits and we have to do something with them, and there's not many other good options, and the government was truthful about what was going on, people would suddenly go, oh, okay, well, yeah, what system can we come up with? But at the moment, what happens in the media is the asylum seekers are demonised and said that they're illegals and queue jumpers and all this other jargon that legitimises being able to place them in a camp which is designed around deterrence and designed around making it so horrible that they don't want to come to Australia and don't want to get on boats. And that policy, the deterrence policy, is what people are angry about, not so much about people going in and assisting asylum seekers and providing medical services and food services. It's about the idea of making these camps so horrible that they don't want to get to Australia.
But weren't people against detention centres even when they weren't offshore?
Yeah, I agreed. But again, if you look at the idea of a detention centre and combine it with the idea of indefinite detention, That's a policy we don't put to our hardest of criminals. Most asylum seekers won't spend 20 years in jail, but when they're placed in these centres and said, you have no idea when you'll get out, there's no progress. So every day feels like the same. And there's no idea of when you can leave and no idea of how you can plan and what will happen to you when you leave. So this idea of indefinite detention it plays on people's minds, and it's actually been documented in a lot of reports in Australia that say that this is directly affects people's mental health.
And why did you feel guilty, if you know, like going over there? Because it seemed like you were there for a good reason. Like, I didn't understand what the sort of like the negative side of you being there was.
So
I understood it like in theory, but you're feeling bad because you're going there to be of assistance to these people for the Salvation Army. That sounds like a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, that the ideals of going over there are great, but in reality, when you're there, all you're really doing is, I mean, you're at the forefront of these men's anger, grief and sadness, and all the immediate reactions to this policy and the way these men feel is directed at us, the workers, the most compassionate people who were there. And so every day we were dealing with them to asking us why they were there and what they were doing there and how they can leave. And essentially our job was to go out and help the men. And that was what we were told. That was a direct quote saying, you go out and help the men. And really, what could we do to help them? And this policy where that that's created by the Australian government was voted for by the Australian people. So as a people and as a country, we did feel responsible because our countrymen had put these people in this position that we were having to deal with and see the realities of.
So in the last chapter, that's what you say. You say we've reached an impasse where those who want to help all asylum seekers are criticised for being naive and are told that we will be swamped if we have an open door policy. And we've got the others, of course, who want to save lives, allegedly, and stop boats. How did we get to this impasse? It's taken a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think the if you map out the debate, it seems like the left and right have gone further and further apart. And so the left have this idea that we have to open the borders. And we have to. This is the extreme left and the extreme right, I should say. And they have this idea that we have to open the borders and accept everyone, which I don't agree with. But I also don't agree with this idea of the right, who I think the idea of saving lives at sea is just another reason, and it can be combined with all the other reasons we've given in the past about more or less controlling our borders and deciding who comes to our shores and how they come. And I think there needs to be a change in language, and I think that's the first step, because at the moment, the way that that this debate's framed legitimises all the other actions that we're taking.
And are you going to get in trouble for publishing this book?
Well, I hope not. I mean, we don't live in countries like, I guess, extremist countries where you, like China, say. But at the same time, who knows what this government may seek to do with it. The advice I was given was that the contracts I signed where you cannot talk about anything in the camp for all time were draconian and couldn't be enforced. But we'll see what happens.
The book is called The Undesirables. Thank you very much for joining us, Mark Isaacs.
Thank you.
You're listening to Sunday Night Safran on Triple J.
Did you look up that thing about who...
Yeah, I looked up the quote. It's too confusing. There's a Noah one.
And an Abraham
one. Yeah, Noah gets drunk. But in that one, it's really confusing. Like, it seems like not a good storyline. Like, he gets drunk and he's lying there naked.
Yes.
Then his son comes in and covers him up and then leaves.
Yes. Now, that's another one.
Yeah, that doesn't seem high stakes. But there is another one.
Yeah.
Where someone gets their father drunk.
Yes.
To then get busy with him.
Oh.
And I'd prefer, rather than stumbling through it this week, to like go off
research,
to do my research and then with confidence.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so stay tuned next week.
Which is typical of our research. I mean, we wouldn't let anything out that was half researched. No, thank you for that.
Never. Hey, Lachlan Murdoch might be taking over the empire. He's been given a big job. I mentioned that because when I heard that there's been moves done at News Limited, you know, I once had dinner with Lachlan Murdoch.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Are you looking for a job?
No, not looking for a job. And he put a lot of effort into looking like a regular person and coming across as a regular person. I was sitting next to him. It was at this launch of an issue of a magazine where I'd written a story within. So everyone who'd written stories within it were at this, and this was his little pet project. It was called Australian Style Magazine. And I sat next to him, and he said, "Oh, John, do you want some of these?" And he moved stuff over his plate to my plate, but it was in a slightly affected way. Like, you know, like, hey, you probably don't think I'm the type of guy who would do this. Oh. Have I kind of twisted your reality now, John?
Ah. But did you exchange pleasantries?
Yeah, it was okay.
Yeah?
Or whatever. He told me about the time he was rejected from a nightclub. He said that was this...
Ejected or rejected?
Rejected. And he said it was this, not turning point in his life, but it kind of showed him. Because he was, like, infuriated at first. He's like, don't these people know who I am? I'm Lachlan Murdoch. But then he goes, no. What right do I have to just float through
nice,
life?
That's isn't it?
Yes. So whoever rejected Lachlan Murdoch from the nightclub
has done him a favour.
When he was passing stuff from his plate over to me, he passed on that. So you did him a good deed.
But is this now Lachlan Murdoch, or is it 20 years ago?
Oh, are you saying he could have turned?
Is this, you don't remember?
The what?
How long ago was this? Lunch, dinner, whatever it was.
Oh, I don't know. Oh, whatever.
Because
like
people
years.
Change, I
yeah,
know.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Well, I haven't got any stories to talk about, you know, sitting down next to somebody who shared their, you know, with
well,
me.
Well, what's the most famous person you've ever met?
No.
You've never met any famous people?
No, I don't think so. Well, Pratts, when we were mixed up with the Pratts at Raheen, that was beautiful.
I know the Pratts are a famous name.
No, but
name.
You were sort of talking about, you want the A-list.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, no. Your average listener is not sitting there. Like, at least with Murdoch, there's like a bit of a name.
Yeah, there is.
And he's like married to...
Well, they would have remembered.
He's married to that beauty queen. What's her name? Sarah O'Hare. O'Hare
is it?
What? Yes. Well, what was the Pratt disaster?
No. I broke a fork, that's all. But, I mean, it was the Pratts. Now, surely they've heard of Richard Pratt in the old
yes.
days, Visi board and all that.
Yes.
But there I am, not quite outclassed, because the glorious house they were in, and we held meetings there, board meetings, and Jeannie was on my board, believe it or not. But that house was already the Archbishop of Melbourne's house before it was sold to the Pratts, you see. So I knew
Have you curved this back to Vatican II again, this
story? I'm going back there gradually.
Do you know the most famous person I've met? And listeners will be far more impressed. Yes, most famous person I've met ever. Selma Hayek.
Oh, you told me that about 5 years ago.
Yes.
She was really on your mind then, Selma Hayek. Wasn't she? And I couldn't work out who it was. I thought she sounded like some kind of a member of Hamas or something.
But I learned a lesson from her or from the experience. This was a thing. So it's in Los Angeles, and I got, you know, I ended up at this party that she was hosting.
Yes.
And when I got there, it was all, like, confusing. I didn't quite know what was happening. And, like, everyone was, like, in little cocktail dresses and dressed to the nines and, like, people I'd seen on ads, you know, for Party of Five and things like that.
Did you turn up in a cocktail dress?
No, I didn't.
You were trying to attract attention to yourself.
And then I understood what I understood was, and because I couldn't quite understand what the context of the party was. And then Selma Hayek, and it was just like in a big hotel room. And then Selma Hayek went to the front and she pulled down a screen and she played this, like, there was like a projector, and she played this documentary that went on for half an hour about prostitutes being murdered in Mexico and, like, the Secret Service covering it up. So it was one of these things which I'm sure, like, the base of it was, you know, like, truthful and a truthful thing. And then, but then there was a slight on top of it, something that, like, whiffed a bit of this is the most conspiracy theory interpretation of it. And I was like, why am I here in this penthouse with all these people in cocktail dresses from Party of Five and Dawson's Creek, watching this thing on the... As Selma Hayek shows this film about murdered...
prostitutes.
Sex workers in Mexico. And then what it was that she'd been brought on to be, like, executive producer of Ugly Betty or whatever. So they wanted to host a party, but for her... In her mind, she wanted to show that she wanted to do, like, a social justice thing and not just a shallow party.
Nice.
So thus this.
Yeah, that's nice.
And so that's why we're watching it. And that's when I realized that in Los Angeles, if you're making money for people, they'll let you do anything, like, both ways. So if you want to be really hedonistic and, you know, snort drugs, that will be allowed because you're making money for people. So do what you want. But then the other side of it is if you want to... You know,
be socially active.
Yeah, be in a hotel room and make your party, and at your party, pull down a screen and show a documentary about murdered sex. You can also do that because I'll put up with anything because Selma Hayek, you're making money for us. So if this is your little thing.
Yeah.
And then everyone just moved on with the party as if we hadn't just watched this half hour thing about murdered sex workers.
But she'd done her job as the sponsor or the patron or whatever it was. Of that rescue operation.
Anyway, that was the most famous person I ever met. The end.
Yeah. Oh, well, one of these days I'll be able to claim that I'd met you.
Oh, you're so humble, Bob. Yes, you're so humble, Bob. I'm sure, you know, you just mix with the common people.
Are we going to?
Yeah, we're going to a song.
Sunday Night Saffron on Triple J.
You're listening to Sunday Night Saffron on Triple J with me, Bob McGuire, and that young bloke over there, John Saffron.
And our guest in the studio is Bryony Kimmings, and with her 9-year-old niece, Taylor, they do a project called The Credible, Likeable, Superstar, Role Model. Thank you very much for joining us, Bryony.
That's all right. Thanks for having me on.
So what happened to the niece? Why is she not here?
It's bedtime.
Bedtime.
Mm-hmm.
Now, drinking.
Can you tell us about this project, the Credible, Likeable, Superstar Role Model?
Of course I can. It stemmed from a conversation with my niece about 2 years ago about what she wanted to be when she was older. And she said she'd quite like to be on a television programme called The Only Way is Essex, which is a bit... Do you have it here? Probably not. It's a bit like The Kardashians. It's sort of a fly on the wall. Definitely presents a very limited version of what females are like. And it just really shocked me. I realised I hadn't really been around tweens for a long time or really seen things through their eyes for a long time. So I asked her to invent a pop star. Most of my work is a social experiment of some kind, a bit like you, I hear. And, so I asked her to invent a pop star that she thought would be a good alternative to kind of sexualised, commodified pop. She invented one. I brought her to life with lots of people that came to help us. It's an education project in schools. It's a documentary.
What did she come up with?
Oh, my God. She came up with Catherine Bennett, a paleontological tuna pasta eating pop star who works in a museum by day and writes songs about animals and friendship at night.
But is she dressed up as a knight or something?
Well, no. The pop star is for tweens and she exists in the real world and kind of does gigs and goes to schools and stuff. And then the show that I've brought here with my niece is the show about why we might do that. It's a show for adults. And in that show, we dress as knights.
Ah, now I get it.
Yeah.
And did she come up with anything you didn't like? Like, you know how people are complicated, so sometimes there's an aspect where they do want to follow a stereotype?
Yeah, I think she doesn't dress provocatively, but she's got blonde hair that's kind of coiffed or however you say that. She wears a lot of makeup. That was Taylor's choice. So there's some things that if I was going to kind of present my own rock and roll feminist pop star, she wouldn't necessarily be exactly the same as this, but the kind of beauty of it was this is what a nine-year-old wanted, and I like that.
And what other social experiments have you done?
My last one was with a team of neuroscientists where I spent 7 days in a controlled environment getting drunk in the name of art to kind of try to figure out whether art and alcohol were linked really in any kind of credible way.
And what did the scientists do in that project?
There was a couple of neuroscientists who measured my brain waves and kind of interviewed me and interviewed audiences that came to see my art. There was psychologists, again, who interviewed me and studied me. And a couple of psychologists came up with the experiment as well, how to put me into controlled conditions that were scientific rather than just, you know, drinking.
And what conclusions did they come up with after your drinking?
Annoyingly, that I was a much better artist the drunker I got.
Oh, no. That's no good. Cause that's like...
I know. Because I don't really drink when I'm making work. I mean, I guess I kind of bought into that sort of artistic ethos that is kind of that is the culture of it. But I was doing the experiment was inspired by a friend who was an alcoholic who kind of really relied on drinking to write. And so she went to rehab and I went into this experiment and I wanted to prove to her that it was all nonsense. But there's quite a lot of links because of it makes you relaxed and it makes you confident.
Mm.
So it was interesting, though, really interesting.
Because
I
don't admit to that at all.
While reading the book, come on, confess here.
What?
When you're reading that detective, not those detective, you say that you drink the whiskey because the character in the book
on the TV show on True Detective. But that's not me being creative.
He wants to empathise.
That's me empathising with the characters on the thing. That's different to being creative. But we've got heroes, instead of Shiva and Muhammad and Noah and stuff, like we've got a few, and one's Theodore Dalrymple, this UK psychologist and doctor, and he's written a lot about the opposite where he's trying to prove, or at least try to show that lots of artists aren't drunk and drug addicts and they did do all their best work.
When they were sober. That's a lot of writing around that, isn't there? That actually, although they were sort of famed for being inebriated, they actually did their work and then they got drunk, you know. But yeah, that was interesting. And the project before that, which I'm also doing here in Melbourne, was called Sex Idiot, and that was about getting a positive sexual health test result and then going back and trying to figure out who gave that to me.
Who done it?
It was a who done it.
Oh, so you mean positive in the science sense, not positive in a good sense.
As in like a it was positive. I had something. And I'd never had one before, stupid girl. I was like reached 30 and I'd never had one. And so I had one and
was
then
it a
I
bad
had to
one?
Figure it out. No, it wasn't a bad one. It was a curable one.
Do most people have them and they just don't know?
Yes. A lot of people have them and they don't know. A lot of people have them and don't tell anyone, which is, you know, socially irresponsible. So I thought the doctor offered to write an anonymous letter to anyone I thought I might have given it to. But I thought that was a bit cowardice. So I sort of began this journey. And yeah, the show's about what happens when you try and...
And so you tracked down the person who'd given it to you?
I did, actually.
And how did you record this? Was there like a little camera crew following you
about? I didn't actually do a doc for that one. I did a doc for 7 Day Drunk, which is the alcohol one. And for this one, there's a doc. But no, I recorded a lot. And I emailed backwards and forwards, and then I interviewed people.
And then what was it going to be, the final presentation of this, like a live show or something?
It's a live show, yeah. And it's I decided that if people helped me, I'd make a small piece of performance for them. So the show is essentially the story of what happened, and then each performance that's made for each of those people to thank them for helping me.
It's so interesting doing things like that where you're not, like, filming at all.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of... I don't know, it's just there's something nice about that.
It is quite nice, isn't it? It becomes a creative project rather than just like a documentation of a period of time. And I think creative responses to things are just as beautiful. But yeah, that's playing at the comedy festival, that show.
I used to always think that you had to like film everything because people wouldn't believe the story unless it was filmed. Like it was like, and people are going to try to trip you up and then you're going to be able to show the film. But it's not true. It's like if you tell a truth, somehow people can just vibe when something's true. So like in this case, you going around, going back to all these people and trying to find, like, as long as it's the truth, it comes across as the truth, and then it's all cool.
And everyone loves stories, don't they? Like, down the pub, all we do is tell stories. Everybody likes to hear people's private lives. Like, so I guess it kind of taps into that idea of, like, yeah, the storytelling.
And then also in this case, because you're not filming, you're getting more kind of casual or honest or less, like, reactions from all the people, and they're willing to discuss things more than if they thought... Hang on, this is a Keeping Up with the Essex Kardashians kind of show or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
So you actually get a better story to tell at the end of it because people are relating to you on that level.
Yeah, it's true.
Credible, likeable superstar role model is aimed at...
It's for adults, that show, the show itself.
Oh, because that could be confusing because you've got a 9-year-old in it. They might think it's like The Wiggles or something. And then
Not. We do a kids show in the UK.
You do.
And that's all about Catherine Bennett and how we made her and we got played on Radio 1. But this is the show about why I would ever want to do this with my niece. It's about the sexualisation of youth. It's quite hardcore.
So you wouldn't get away with it before... secondary school students, college students?
I say 14 plus can come and see it because I think you're beginning to see the world in a different way then.
Mm.
You know, you're beginning to sort of, the shine's coming off, you're seeing how maybe you're being manipulated.
There's this Australian, you'd call Helen Razor a feminist. She'd be happy with that, would she be with that? She's like a commentator and a comedian and a feminist. And she's always having a go at feminists who are making too much of a big deal about the sexualization of children.
Really?
Like she's sort of saying that, everyone kind of, I think her general argument, she's going to get, Helen, if you're listening to this, and I'm misrepresenting you, feel free to just clear it up. But it's more like everything's a bit more sophisticated than that. And so if a girl dresses up as a harlot, she gets it.
I understand. I think what maybe is confused is being sexy and what's being objectified. And I think what's really a problem for me is when young women see women being objectified, therefore being treated as objects, that they need someone else to complete them or that they see themselves as objects. That's different than having a choice to be sexy and to experiment with sexuality. Do you see what I mean? And I think actually that's probably much more what I'm concerned with. And aren't you two feminists?
Of course.
Yeah, good. Well, I'm just checking.
What do you have to be a feminist?
You have to believe that men and women are entitled to equal rights.
How about this? I was thinking about how my two favourite writers, well, probably at least equal first place, are Flannery O'Connor, a Southern Gothic writer, and also Janet Malcolm, who wrote The Journalist and the Murderer. And then I was thinking, seeing they're my two favourite writers, or at least, doesn't that make me a feminist in it or not? Does it not work like that?
I think if you just believe that men and women are equal, you're a feminist.
That would do, that's, I think, all, John. Yeah,
enough?
He likes to overthink things.
Yeah,
Okay, fair enough.
No, but it's an art.
It's an art.
It's an art. Oh, yes, there's nothing eccentric about it. Don't take it personally.
Now, where can people see your
Here,
show?
It's down the street from you.
Yeah, St Kilda.
14 Ackland Street, St Kilda.
Yeah, well, yeah,
Theatre
well,
Works.
That's Theatre Works. That's the that's
Tuesday, 25th of March to Friday, the 28th of March, 7:30 at night. What? Saturday, the 29th of March, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Tuesday, the 1st of April, till yeah, okay. Saturday, the there it is.
You don't have to give that much. There would be a way to kind of just sum up. Anyway, they can just type in your name to the internet.
He's got me already. Look at this.
Yeah, he's already taken
I told you
off.
That.
You can just type that into the internet and find out where Bryony Kimmings is appearing. Thank you so much for telling us all about your art and for coming in
That's
and spending
right.
time
Thanks
with us.
Thanks for having me.
Sunday Night Safran.
With John Safran and Father Bob Maguire on Triple J.
You're listening to Sunday Night Safran with me, Bob Maguire, and John Safran.
You know Mindy Kaling?
Of course.
She's that Indian-American actress, as in India, as in Tamil father and Bengali mother, both Hindus from India. And she was in the US version of The Office and now is in a TV show called Mindy Project. And the Media Action Network for Asian Americans is not happy with her. While thanking Fox for renewing the Mindy Project for a third season, they are asking the network to end the white-only dating policy of series creator and star Mindy Kaling. Because apparently she repeatedly dates in the show. I haven't watched it. But all her love interests are white.
White Anglos.
Yeah, I don't know if they're Anglos, they're white. We're concerned that in the course of two seasons, her character, Dr. Lahiri, has had a whites-only dating policy involving about a dozen men. Since Kaling is the showrunner, that's the American version of being an executive, the woman in charge, seeing Kaling is in charge of the show, this obviously reflects her values. Even more Trump, so they're having a go at her now. That they're not saying, oh, this is big, evil, white Hollywood forcing her to go out with...
Sure.
Now they're hassling Mindy for wanting to date white guys, at least hypothetically on her show. Even more troubling has been her defensive comments while asked about the lack of diversity in her character's romantic interests. She has a strangely defensive response to Entertainment Weekly. This is what she said. Do people really wonder on other shows if female leads are dating multicultural people? Like I owe it to every race and minority and beleaguered person? I have to become the United Nations of shows?
Fair comment, isn't it?
Fair enough. So, yes, she's... So Mindy's in there. That seems like, you know, like Jewish grandparents hassling their grandchildren to date Jews. It seems like maybe like you should be talking about Asian representation or Indian representation on, you know, hassling.
Yeah, but she says
an Indian a girl for dating white guys just seems
very complicated,
slightly weird,
isn't it?
Yes,
not for your lot because I mean not your personal. I mean your age group. It goes on and on and on and on. We're beyond it, us poor old devils.
Yes. What do you think about
my dating? You don't ask me that, for God's sake.
What do you think about Gwyneth Paltrow?
Yeah, Gwyneth Paltrow.
Breaking up with her husband.
Truly.
The guy from Coldplay.
After how long?
I don't know.
Doesn't matter to us.
She put it out. She used all this weird modern language to make out, you know, it wasn't just like a split. Like it was something more organic and natural that we can all get along with.
Yeah, we're good friends still.
No, she used like weird sort of managerial speak kind of PC language to make out like, oh, it's just another phase in life. But maybe it is. You've heard that argument that because we live for so long these days, you shouldn't have to stick with the one person.
No, that's an argument these days. How could you possibly bond with one other human being for 60 years? That frightens people.
Can you cover for me whilst I, because I'm trying
well,
to...
Well, I'm still concerned.
Conscious uncoupling, that's the expression they use.
Conscious uncoupling.
Yeah, that's a kind of...
That's nice, isn't it?
That Gwyneth Paltrow and Chris Martin use to...
That's nice. Mix. There should be a ceremony somewhere for a civil celebrant to preside over a ritual of conscious uncoupling.
But maybe the chickens come home to roost when you're really old and, like, maybe it was better to stick with the one person because then you're not, like... dying alone in your flat with no one to, like, go down the street and bring you some soup.
But then again, maybe your several conscious uncouple.
Conscious uncouple.
Yes. We'll all be there at the end, you see, and said we have a marvellous relationship, the six of us.
I know. I've got a work colleague, a bit older than me, who's triggered in her brain that her and some female friends are going to be friends forever, and then they're all going to move into, like, when
retirement
they get...
Retirement village
when they're really old.
Oh, that's nice.
But I don't know whether you can bank on that, man. Because one of her friends is just going to meet some guy and then she's gone. As if this friend's going to go, oh, listen, I've met this man and he's wonderful. I want to spend my life
but
with
maybe
him.
But maybe women are able to be loyal together no matter what. For yonks, maybe that's true. Whereas blokes will be more flippant.
Yes.
Retired priest's homes. Are we all mates forever? Or does something happen to us when we go into retirement villages? I don't know. So you're talking about planned retirement villages for conscious, uncoupled persons. I like that.
Sunday Night Saffron. Triple J.
Bob.
Yep.
What do you reckon about the racial...
Oh, it's difficult to understand.
...discrimination law. Oh, and they're taking out one of the parts of the law where previously you couldn't intimidate or vilify or blah.
What does it all mean? What does it mean? I need a list now.
I think it's a real... everyone loses their bearings by localising this to the Andrew Bolt situation.
That's what they're doing.
Because then it becomes like, oh, if you like Andrew Bolt, you support the change in the law. Mm-hmm. And if you don't like Andrew Bolt... Mm-hmm. You don't support the change in the law. But I think it's a very immature way of looking at the law that you want to run a law so in this very moment, in this instance, you can get back at this guy you don't like when really the law will be able to be applied in lots of broader, different, unexpected contexts, not just now but in 5-10 years' time. So you got to think about that. And there's that saying that be careful what you wish for because it might
Indeed.
Come true.
Well, are you agreeing with it or not?
No, but do I agree with what?
Mr. Brandis's suggested legislation, well, change to the law.
Give
me an example.
Let me give you, do you know at the moment there's an anti-Zionist academic by the name of Jake Lynch.
Where is he?
And he's in a court case because he's been brought to court because someone's saying he's breaching the Racial Discrimination Act because he's he's being in effect sort of like trying to cut off opportunities for people he sees as Zionists or whatever. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's a different part of the act. As then what Brandis is talking about on the one hand. But on the other hand, you can see how you can just apply you can apply these sorts of things to the same people who hate Andrew Bolt are likely to like Jake Lynch.
Yes, I understand.
So I'm explaining this really badly. Can I go back in time? This is what I'm getting at. Everyone's making out like, oh, the only way this law will ever be applied is to attack rich white people. When really, when it comes to sort of vilifying and having little pokes at each other, there's lots of like little ethnic groups who try to do it to each other. And so the law may be introduced in that way. Someone might say, a Turk might go, I don't like the way these Armenians are talking.
Yeah,
they're vilifying, this Armenian Australian is vilifying us Turks by saying we all killed them and we're monsters or whatever. So,
can't you say that?
I'm just saying that people are very immature because they're just looking at this case as if it's like Andrew Bolt or that the only...
No, I know what you mean, yeah.
The only variable that's ever going to go on is evil, rich... white person versus, a person who's a member of a marginalised group, when really a lot of vilifying happens intra-marginalised groups.
Mm. Well, the two Tims will help us, won't they? Tim Soutphommesane, no? And also Tim Wilson surely will be the watchdogs and say you've gone too far with legislation.
Mm.
Adam Goodes, the Australian of the Year, is taking he's arguing.
And the problem with the Bolt case is, this is what the problem is, the Bolt case was basically a faux defamation case.
Yes.
Like, that's what he was tripped up under, that he said these things that were defamatory, but he happened to be being charged under the racial vilification thing. But so then it becomes this big tangle because people say, well, no, everything he said you could actually say without the defamation.
Isn't it all about good manners?
No.
No. No, but shouldn't we just have an innate sense?
Okay, so good manners is not...
Innate sense, I'm saying, of what not to say.
Hmm.
But you can't trust that. You've got to legislate for it.
So do you think that the someone who's an anti-Zionist who protests outside a business
shouldn't do
that's
it.
Owned by Israeli Australians, should they be able to be prosecuted under some racial vilification legislation?
Well, it's bad manners, but it's also presumably bad morals, isn't it?
I don't know.
I don't know either, but I mean, we're all going to get picked up.
You know, Chinese Australians think that... that whole Tibetan thing where they set up little protests and they complain about the Chinese, that makes them wince, you know.
The Chinese?
Yeah, Chinese Australians. Yeah. They're like, why are you vilifying us Chinese with this bullshit about how we have invaded Tibet? And they're like angry about that. So will there be some variation there where they'll be one of those groups will bring the other group to the courts and saying you're vilifying my group?
Is it not better to have it all out in the open?
Yes, but that's what George Brandis says. So you're supporting Roland?
I'd rather have it all out in the open, but then I'm just nervous that, in fact, the elite in our society will, in fact, use it to their own benefit. That's all I'm saying.
Mm.
So it will protect them, whereas it won't protect...
I reckon my point there was good, but I explained it bad at the start and I fumbled, which is unfortunate because it was like a real interesting point.
Do you want to refumble it or what?
No, I don't know. As long as you understood it.
No, I understood it clearly and exactly, and listeners will do too.
Okay, sorry about that. It's not my fault.
No.
Well, it kind of is. Well, anyway.
In fact, we're finished.
Oh, we need to say goodbye
now. It's time to wrap up.
Yeah, sure.
Let's thank the guests, for example, writer and comedian Doc Brown.
Thanks, Doc.
Author of The Undesirables, Mark Isaacs.
Thanks, Mr. Isaacs.
And your friend.
What?
Performance artist, Bryony Kimmings.
Thank you, Ms.
Kimmings. You can keep in touch with us via our Twitter. Send us a tweet at Father Bob or at John Safran. You can also tweet our producer, at Soipl, S-O-I-P-L.
You can download tomorrow. This is a podcast.
Facebook page.
You go to abc.net.au.
Yeah, there's all kinds of goodies there. Look, podcast. iTunes or SoundCloud.
This is a disaster.
Next up, stay tuned for Fenella Kernabone.
Hey, Fenella.
That's it from us, ladies and gentlemen. Back next week.
Bye.